Today is Wednesday, April 17th, 2013. And I'm sitting here getting ready to talk with John Polk about memories of WHAS. John, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. You stimulated my memory yesterday, so I've been thinking about the good old days of HAS.
We're actually sitting here at the American Printing House for the Blind, where we both record books, and we've got John just ahead of his schedule here, and we're going to talk with him some. John, you're from Louisville, aren't you?
I'm from Louisville.
You grew up here?
Yeah.
Well, where did you go to school?
Went to Ian Bloom, which is a great school, which is right here in Barcelona, then Barrett Junior High. Back before they had middle schools, and then Atherton graduated in 67, left to go to the Navy. I had a brief stint at the Naval Academy and got appointed there. Decided this was during the Vietnam era, and I decided that the military wasn't for me, so I left the Naval Academy only to be drafted right back into the Navy.
Really?
And spent a couple of years on a destroyer in Vietnam, and then we got out in 71 and went to see, actually enrolled at University of Kentucky and stayed there a couple of years. Got married, had a kid, came back I didn't come to HAS then. I got hired by a station which is now WRKA, but had been WSTN.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it played the kind of music that WHAS played. And I remember that during those years, looking up to this new gang at WHAS Radio.
And was this came out? Was it an FM station?
It was an FM station. Alan Brown ended up at Wave. Several people that ended up at either Wave or WHAS were there. But I remember hearing about this new crew that had come into town.
Hmm.
That was you and Wayne Perkey. Yes. And I think Jeff Douglas and
Jerry David Malloy,
and then there were the old staples, you know, Milton Matz, and who did the talk show at night. And I remember thinking, I want to work at that station.
Yeah, right.
And I had to take a detour to Indianapolis first, got a job with the big stations up there, IBC and NAB.
Oh, yeah.
Counterparts roughly to WHAS.
By the way, was a fellow named Roy Cooper at WIBC. Remember?
Yes.
Manager?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I worked with Roy years ago in Evansville, Indiana, when he was locking Roy.
It's a small world in the radio world, yeah. So I spent 2 years there, and for about 6-8 months, I was courting WHAS, and they were courting me. This was Hugh Barr, of course.
He was his face.
Yeah, they needed to get you guys some time off. They didn't have a swing guy. You'd get your vacations,
but
you'd have to extend your shifts or whatever you had to do. And so he eventually considered me for the afternoon drive spot, and then Gary Burbank was available.
This is in the middle, you came
to this is 76.
76. How did you get, by the way, to... Were you exposed to radio in high school or in college?
Actually,
in the Navy?
During the Navy.
During the Navy, really?
I need some employment to get me through school.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to work at the soda shop or at McDonald's, so I said, you know, what can I do? Well, I've always enjoyed...
Did you listen to radio when you were a kid then?
Listen to rock radio, WAKY and WKLO, who were big rivals, and 40 radio when I was growing up. And they used to have a competition at WKLO where they would let a student actually do a shift. You had to win the opportunity.
Like a high school student.
And you had to audition.
And I
didn't win, but that's what got me started. And then during the Navy, I took a broadcasting course. Remember the Columbia School of Broadcasting?
Sure do, yeah.
Yeah. And I had a guy from KCBS in San Francisco who was my mentor in that program and would review my tapes, for the real tapes, who I'd report on board ship and send.
How about this?
On board ship. And,
like a correspondence type?
Correspondence kind of thing. But with a guy who was a major CBS newsman.
Did you do some broadcasting?
No, we didn't have a little radio station or anything like that. But when I got back to town, I decided to apply for a job at the University of Radio Station at the University of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the call letters were WBKY.
Hmm.
And then stayed there a couple of years and then got the job at WSTN. And from there, go to the IDC, NAP, and then finally hired at HAS, where I had always wanted to work anyway.
Because now, when you're listening to HAS, by this time you've gone to Boston.
Oh, yeah. Because of the clear channel, the skywave at night, you could hear HAS anywhere at night. So I would listen a lot at night, and there was a guy on at night that I really liked. That was in the era of progressive rock, and here was this old staid, you know, community radio station, 50,000 clear channel watts, and all of a sudden they were playing Pink Floyd and all this stuff late at night. His name was Dave McCree, and I said, boy, I love that guy's voice. You know, and he is really good at this, all this stuff. I ended up working in the production room that at one time had been, you know, the air, the on-air studio that all you guys used, including him. I remember first walking in there, so this is where it all happened.
How about that?
And I looked at it, it's not much, is it?
So you remember the day that you walked in for the first time? It was, the studios were there at 6th and Chestnut,
right,
on Armory Place in Chestnut. Pretty impressive building, really nice lobby and everything.
Way more impressive than the one I came from in Indianapolis.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And so I thought I had made it. The interesting side, like the general manager at WIBC had been a former program director and air personality, and he called me into his office. The day I had accepted the job at WHAS, Hugh Bark had called me that day, and I said, I'm coming. I've already been down to visit, and so they called me in to their office, and his name was Jim Hilliard, and he said, listen, We'd like to offer you a job in Philadelphia, because they had a chain of stations. And they were fighting over whether the program director in Indianapolis would get me as their production guy, or whether the guy in Philadelphia would get me. And he, so Jim Hilliard says, let's settle this. Why don't we ask him?
What would you like to do?
And there they were, and they went through this spiel where they were fighting over me for 5 minutes. And I said, hold on. I can't let this go on any further. I got to be straight with you guys. I just got an offer from WHAS, and Jim looked at me, and he said, you know, we looked into buying that station. Why would you want to go there? And I said, in that question, Jim, is the reason I'm going.
How about that?
Because you don't understand, you know, how important that radio station is to the community.
Yeah.
And although you built something very good here, it's nothing like WHAS.
How about that?
And I've always wanted to work there, and I finally got a chance. So I'm going.
There you were.
Yeah.
And you were doing production in Indianapolis.
Right.
Were you doing an air shift also? Or
no.
Air production.
That was what was a little scary, because one of the reasons Hugh hired me was to do not only production, to assist Jim Ferguson, the production director, for both the AM station,
yeah,
you know, 840, and the FM station, which at the time was playing classical music,
mm-hmm,
getting ready to switch over to country.
Oh, yeah.
Now to the AMC.
Yeah.
But he wanted me to be the swing guy. In other words, to fill in on vacation time. Well, mm-hmm, you guys had like 3 or 4 weeks of vacation each. And I did the arithmetic, and I thought, my God, I'm going to be on the air 30 weeks a year. So I subbed for Milton and you and Wayne Perkey. Wayne Perkey had a problem getting up in the morning, by the way, which meant I subbed for him a lot. He would get sick, or he would be, you know, it had been a hard night or whatever, a long week at the station. But
for children or
whatever. Oh, yeah, lots of reasons. He was so good. You see how that guy did everything he could do. But I would work with Barney Arnold.
Oh, yeah.
The famous, you know, farm anchor on the radio for many years, Fred Wishy. And I remember Ken Schultz. On one of the mornings I was
subbing. The weather guy, yeah.
He was new, and he came in, he had a great sense of humor. He then went on to television later and has since retired. And this was his first year there, and he was hired originally by the radio station to be its first meteorologist.
Another Hugh Barr.
Hugh Barr set that up. So there I am doing in Perky's chair. And they used to have these cartridges that you played commercials from and promos that you put into a machine. And it's a great big, huge, round, circular, metal rack,
mm-hmm,
filled with maybe 1,000 of these cartridges, so it weighed a lot, you know. And I'm doing this early morning, like 5:30, little newscast, and Ken Schultz comes in, and we're talking, and we get to talking about a commercial that was just on, which was about BOTS, which is apparently some kind of a disease, or short for a disease that horses get. And there was this cure for it, and it was being advertised in this commercial. And just the name BOTS started to tickle Ken. And we, after the commercial was over, and I said, wait, Ken, can you pull yourself together? And he says, that, I can't stop thinking about what would happen if my horse got BOTS. And we started getting tickled, you know how you do it. He then gets this look on his face, like, I had just pulled some carts out, they called them carts, and put them into the machines, getting ready to run
a commercial, you know,
there they go, while I'm talking to him, and then I turn around and look at him, and he's got this look on his face like a pure terror. He's just been laughing, and now he's got this other look, and I think, oh, he's just pulling my leg. He's trying to make me think somebody's behind me or something. Because he was a cut-up.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't go away, so what's the matter, Ken? He said, look! And the tower of cartridges had the bottom base had broken and it was falling towards me like like a building falling on you and all the cars and it was this huge crash which then precipitated a number of phone calls to make sure John Polk was all right. One of which was Wayne Perkey, who had been this lots of great stories in those days. HAS was such a personality driven station. Which is a tribute to Hugh Barr, because he created that image for the station, and hired people like yourself who could express that, you know, and through an entire shift. And each of the personalities was very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
However, there was a common thread.
That's a good way to put it.
The common thread of a positiveness, a concern for the community. The station could pivot on a dime because of these really talented people who could ad lib.
Yeah,
you were good at that, and I looked up to all of you for doing that and learned how to do it myself.
Grabbing the situation.
Yeah. And if something happened, there would be in the community a tragedy or something positive, like a basketball championship or something, and the station could just pivot all day long. You guys were taking phone calls and playing a little bit of music, but mostly, you know, responding to what was happening in the community.
That's a good way to put it, yeah, responding to what was happening.
Yeah.
I told somebody the other day that we were a talk radio station, but we didn't have anything to say. We played music. But if we had something to say, we just stopped.
Some of those community events were created by the station. If you'll remember, when Hugh Barr hired Gary Burbank, who had been at Wacky, very successful at Wacky, a competitor, and had been out of town for several years, and when he became available, he wanted to come back to Louisville. But he had to have the right deal. And finally, Hugh worked out a deal with him, and he came. And so Gary just brought everybody's game up to another level. And
what kind of, tell people what kind of things he did. He did characters?
He did lots of characters. He brought them with him, and he would go into the production room, and I would have to give him an hour and a half before he was, and he would create what he called bits, and whether it was the Reverend Deuteronomy Skaggs, remember him, or the Eunice and Bernice. Yes. Or Eunice and Bernice, the something sisters, who had spoken unison all the time. Or the news Melissa's at the time, the were two anchors in Mobile, one at Wave, one at WHAS, both named Melissa.
Oh, yeah.
So he had them call in to report something that was going on in the community that was bogus, but they were the news Melissa's. So he had a number of characters like that. And one winter, after he'd been there a couple of years, if you'll remember this, there was a very, very heavy snowstorm. We must have had 16 inches of snow. And it was cold and bitter, and when I think about that today, I think, we don't have snows like that anymore. But Gary put out a snow shark alert. And I had never thought, what's he doing with this? And people began calling in, not just to his show, but to all your show, Wayne's show, with snow shark sightings. Yes, yeah, I just off the Waterson over there, I saw one rear his ugly head, and I saw him for about half a mile, and then he went under again. And that became a thing for a week or two. They still talk about snow sharks.
Yeah.
I think it was a TV spot about snow shark alerts, and it just became a fun community thing to get through the tough, you know, part of the heavy snowstorm. And
that's the way it was, right?
Whether it was something difficult like the 74 tornado and the reporting thereof, which HAS won many awards for,
yeah.
Or whether it was something fun that was created by one of the personalities, or whether it was Christmas shopping season and all of a sudden we stopped playing music and just...
A Christmas shopper's guide.
Shopper's guide, and direct people to where they could find the rare toys.
Oh, yeah.
The community nature of the station was just... I don't think I've experienced anything like it or heard anything like it around the country.
Yeah, it felt like that one time on the Christmas shopper's guide. The first year, and he started talking about it. He was doing it tongue-in-cheek. He said, I want to find some of those black velvet Elvis paintings, you know, and he was kidding around, but somebody called, yeah, Hikes Point there. And so every year he'd call it, and people would call, yeah, they're over here now.
just, unless you open the airwaves to the public, and you manage that right with the right personalities, there's nothing like that.
You were the architect of that, getting the right people in it. But you were the kind of glue to hold all that together, because you would take things into the production room and put them together, too.
Right.
Tell me about your duties in the production room. What were your responsibilities? What did you do?
Well, we had never had a department that did that wrote commercials and produced them for the local ad agencies and clients that on time on the station. So we created a department. It had already begun a little bit before I got there with Jim Ferguson and Branch Bowden. Branch Bowden being the writer producer and. Jim Ferguson was the production director. When I came, I was bringing my expertise in advertising and also my production skills and, of course, my voice. And so now we had a variety of voices to choose from,
mm-hmm.
and we had a couple of good writers. I was a writer, and we put together, actually competed with the best writers and producers in the community to actually come up with campaigns for clients. And the idea was to increase revenue at the station by getting a larger portion of the advertising budget of a particular client.
You're yourself,
yeah. And so if an ad agency was placing times for, say, Big O Sires, time on multiple stations, we wanted to get the larger share of that, or as large a share as we could. So we'd offer to produce their spots for them. And since we had some good writers and good producers, we decided we were going to do just what an advertiser.
That affected in-house advertising.
Exactly. And that worked like a charm.
Sure.
And revenue shot up. And then with the addition of you guys and then Gary Burbank, the station went to number one, which only helped things more.
And it kind of had to be fun to do that kind of thing.
It was a lot of fun.
The commercials.
Right. And then the other side of my job was to create an image for the station. Jim Ferguson had started that, and he and I worked together to create a new sound for the station, much more, in that era, much more like, say, a top 40 radio station or a rock radio station.
Adult-oriented, but still adult-oriented,
to create an image for it. Now, remember, we had University of Kentucky basketball and football, so we were heavily sports-oriented. And we also had mostly news and information in the morning and morning drive, so it wasn't like we could promote music like a music station.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it was about promoting day parts, promoting personalities, promoting the basketball and football coverage, promoting the station and creating an image for it. And so we went through several image campaigns. One of them was transposed the 84 and the WHAS. It had always been WHAS 84.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who came up with this idea. I said, well, let's just transpose it. Let's call it, it'll flow off the tongue more.
And it did, yeah.
84 WHAS. So we did the place on the dial, and the call letters all in one fell swoop. And that then lent itself to some cool ways we could write promos and put them together.
And these were like commercials, basically, and mm-hmm. like throughout the day. They were doing.
Yeah, anywhere from 15 to 60 seconds. We had contests, you know,
oh, yeah.
With
yeah.
prize packages, and this was to build up our ratings, hold on to people longer, you know, have them listen a little bit longer to see if they want to
produce a commercial.
Yeah, basically. Promoting various day parts, yourself, other people, and then putting together the audio and video for TV commercials for the station, which had never been done before. And we put together a campaign called Radioactive.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Sure.
And a commercial was produced for each of the air personalities,
yeah.
and they were just fun things. And it, by the time, let's see, I guess we had that campaign on the air 3-4 months, and it was real, billboards, everything. Everybody was going, that's cool. WHAS is Radioactive.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Another, which fit right into the image of the station, and the way we said it, it didn't have any connotation to nuclear fallout or anything.
Actually,
Radioactive. Radioactive. Well, I'm on the air on a Saturday morning, my regular shift. I forget what year this was. It's 70, maybe, say, 78, maybe, 79. You probably have a better memory than I do, I hope. But I'm on the air Saturday morning, and just the day before, the story had broken about Three Mile Island.
Okay. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And it was at the early stages of what we knew about that, and there was still a great fear that there would be what's called a meltdown. And the public didn't know much about that at that time. You know, Chernobyl had not happened, and so there was a great fear of a meltdown, and people thought that meant, heck, you know, the nuclear, you know, it can just penetrate the earth and contaminate everything, and this is in Pennsylvania. Not that far from here,
right.
And
well,
so there was a great deal of trepidation about that in the community and around the country. So I got a call while I was on the air from the then program director, Jerry David Malloy, and he said, pull all the spots, pull all the radioactive promotions. And it was probably one of the neatest campaigns we'd ever come up with. We spent a lot of money, a lot of time and energy on it, and it just, we couldn't run it. We had to pull it. That then stimulated thinking about another way to go about doing this, and it really did, you know, promoting the station. And it really did, you know, there's always a silver lining. So we, Branch Bowden and myself and Jim Ferguson, and we just all put our heads together and came up with another campaign. And it was more effective in the long run and had a lot more of a sustaining capability over time. But I think it was called Depend On.
Yeah.
Depend On Us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think still use it today.
I think so, yeah.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your typical day like? Did you have a typical day? And maybe one of the things that was great about a production job, there's no real typical day, was there? I mean, you had certain things to do, but all the elements would get mixed up every day. And,
Then
you'd also have a set routine, but then some sales guy would come in and say, this has got to be done now, I'm sure.
One of the toughest times of the year was right prior to the football season.
Why?
Because it was like producing a whole new show that had, in terms of commercials and promos, and there were all kinds of new clients that only bought time during the football and basketball season. And this also happened prior to basketball season, but the big push was about the two or three weeks. And all the salespeople would wait to the last minute to get their clients to come in. And we'd eventually be kind of up against it the last 3 or 4 days before the first game. And I remember just working 12, 15, 18-hour days, and so did some of the other people. I even had some of the air personalities do some production work because I couldn't do it all. Somehow we always made it.
Yeah.
And that was one of the big pushes, and the other push was Derby.
Oh, yeah. And a listener may not realize when they hear the end result how much work went into getting that 30-second spot of that commercial on the air. And then you combine that with many, many other commercials.
And we had made, set a standard of high quality. So it's not like you could just throw every commercial together.
No, because that involved research, getting the right music, mm-hmm. getting the right words, putting it all together, and mm-hmm. editing it, and getting the end result in that cartridge rack so it could fall on you when Ken Schultz was in the studio.
Well, you remember when you would come into the studio and I would hand you 5 pieces of coffee and say, okay, Jack, we got 10 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, because each on-air guy had a certain production shift too. You would use our voices, we would come in to do a commercial, and you put it all together.
Right, yeah. One of the things we did at Derby, you know, the Derby Cup.
I was going to ask you about Derby next.
HAS was, and really, this is another thing Hubar started with, coverage of big events that were more entertainment. It was create something on the air that attracts a larger audience. But it's a community spirit kind of thing, and it just happened to coincide with the beginning of the Derby Festival as being a real festival,
mm-hmm. yeah.
managed by a large group of people and a number of events, and it was really growing fast. So I would go out during the 2 weeks of the Derby Festival and cover all these events, and I'd take a tape recorder with me and interview people, and it's real exciting. It's tiring. And then I bring the pieces in and edit them down and create a little Derby Festival moment, maybe a minute and a half, that would raise the excitement level on the station. We're the only station doing anything like this. We're covering everything. And then on Derby Day, where we went wall-to-wall coverage for
the start of the morning, 6 in the morning.
Yeah. And guys like you would be either out in the infield or on Millionaires Row. I remember Milton. You know, Millionaire's Row,
yeah,
where
yeah.
he wanted to be. Don't put Milton in the infield. Things might happen. The many, many celebrities at the time that he interviewed is just, it's legendary.
Yeah.
I hope HAS kept all those interviews because they really are something. But those would be on the air. Wayne Perkey anchored the coverage. Kay Wood Ledford was his, in the booth with him, calling every race, talking about the upcoming Derby and the not just the odds, but all the backstory. And the previous week, Wayne had been on the backside of Churchill Downs.
Doing his morning show
from there, mm-hmm. and with an engineer, so I think it was me, back at the studio. And he would interview all the trainers and jockeys and owners, and those were just fascinating interviews.
Yeah.
Then you take all of the coverage from Derby Festival Week and then the 16 hours of Derby Day coverage. So let's say it's 25 hours worth of material, all on large 10-inch reel-to-reel
tapes
that had been constantly running from off air. And I would take the big stack of these things into the production room. And while all you guys were like, you had a big long week, the day was over at the end of Derby Day, and you guys were, I don't know, you went to a restaurant, had dinner, had some and I'm back there working my butt off.
How did you find things at all those big takes like that? Had you made notes during the week?
Especially the Derby Day coverage, I had saved stuff from different
mm-hmm.
But the Derby Day coverage, I had to, I was on the air as a coordinating producer. Brent Roden was on the on site, and I was in the studio, you know, running things. And I would make notes during the day, and then when I wasn't on the air, I made notes about what some great pieces, some great things that were going on.
Forming in your mind what else was going on.
And then I would go in with all these tapes, and I have roughly an idea where they were, and they had a little time. This tape is for this hour and a half. So I'd have to actually go through the tapes, almost listen to them linearly, you know, minute by minute, until I found those pieces. And then in the listening, I would hear other things that I hadn't noted that were great. And then, and this is before the days of digital editing, which we had audio tape. And if you were going to edit together a lot of pieces, you had to get your piece of audio tape and tape it up on a shelf or something.
So you would cut it out with a razor blade.
And I'd have a piece that was 7 feet long and a piece that was 3 feet long, and a piece that was just an old snippet that was 2 feet long, and I had them labeled.
Oh, my God.
And I was up until usually 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning on Sunday morning putting this together, because once I had all that done, then I had to splice them all together with, you know, what's called then a splicing wire. Yeah. And then listen and go, oh, that I should move that over here, I should move that over here, because you want, and it was called the Derby Day on television. And they usually ended up, now this is, what, 30 hours worth of material, condensed to between 8 and 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And it got to where, after several years of doing that, people would look forward to
it. Oh, yeah, they'd go, where is the montage? Yeah. What are you doing? Yeah. 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 That was a masterpiece. Yeah.
And I think that they may still do that, because I know they still have Derby coverage, yeah, and it's still important for them to do that. And in fact, it was so successful doing that that we started doing Crusade for Children.
Yeah.
Yeah. Montages. Which put together all the entertainment and the various important things, like the fire department that had the, you know, the largest donations or, you know, whatever. And I would, during the crusade, I would go down and interview the different fire department chiefs and ancillary personnel, sometimes just kids, and I would put together these montages of not only the coverage and the entertainment, but also the, you know, some of the people who were volunteering to help. And put together a montage for that, and the fire department personnel, all of whom compete, you know, to raise the most money for the Crusade for Children, they would then look forward to their montage to see if they were mentioned. And it got to the point where I had to mention, I have to include every fire department.
Wow.
A lot of fun to do that.
Fun time. Yeah, hard work, a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. That was the thing about it. It was hard work, but it was fun and rewarding, and that was good. You mentioned awards a while ago. Wasn't there something called the Leos? Do they still do that?
The Louis.
Louis. Yeah, the Louis. It was a local advertising club.
Right. They started those awards, I guess, at some point in the 70s. And when I think HAS had not submitted many entries until we had a writing team and a production team. And the first year I was there, they'd won a few Louis before that for some promos and for some coverages. They used to get Louis for news and sportscasts. And that's where the station won its awards mostly. Then they started, but not in the advertising awards as much. And so when I got there, Branch and I put together our heads, and we came up with a lot of great campaigns for radio stations, for ad agencies and clients. And I remember for about 2 or 3 years, we stole the limelight at the Louis Awards from the mainstream ad agencies, because we were doing such a great job coming up with campaigns and great commercials and effective commercials. In fact, one year we submitted the station had Indy 500 coverage, radio coverage, and so one of the promos that I produced for the, was written by then Barbara Owen, who eventually became my wife. Mm-hmm. using some sound I had retained from my days at WNOC, which was the original station that covered the Indy 500. One of their top sportscasters had gone out there and recorded the sound of the, what they used to call champ cars, Indy cars, went in practice and in qualifying. And if you've never heard that sound live, it just goes through you. It is so amazing, the sound. You have to hear it live. But capture it on tape is hard, too, because it's so loud.
Yeah.
And he had captured a really good, maybe 15 minutes of these champ cars, both close up and at distance, coming at you, you know, that feel of a race car coming at you at 200 miles an hour. Well, I had retained some of those tapes because I thought they were cool. And then when it got time to do a promo for HAS's Indy 500 coverage, I thought, I'm going to go dig that up and put together a promo. And so we put together a promo. We're using the sound. It was almost all sound. Really exciting. Use some really hard music. And it won a Clio Award, which is the national advertising awards in the promotional category for radio stations.
Yeah.
And that was the first time HAS had won a Clio.
Yeah.
So for that period of time, with the help, it was really a team effort. The station really did create an image of being, for advertisers and for listeners, a home to really dynamic coverage of local events, sporting events, and commercial. Commercials sometimes are not easy to listen to.
Yeah.
We try to make them entertaining and fun. French Bowden was a tremendous writer, and we loved putting together some of the funny commercials we did. We wanted to entertain our audience as well as get them into the store.
Well, I remember that part of Hugh's philosophy, too, was that, we don't want people to tune out during commercials, but that's part of your program. And so they made them part of the program.
Exactly.
I like to even lead into it. If I knew some particular funny line was coming up, you could set it up that way.
Right.
Come out of it with a comment or something. But of course, they were that way. They weren't just standard run-of-the-mill commercials. They had something that people would talk about.
Sure.
Yeah.
Really was a... I was at HAS for 10 years. And
it seems like 86
to 85.
And
one thing I do want to say is, and there's very few companies that you work for these days that can match the feeling that you had when you worked for a thing on the company. And the VHS and the VNC and the VHS television were owned by the Courier Journal, which is a privately owned company that the Bingham family owned at the time. And one of the reasons WHAS was able to do so much and be so creative and become the powerhouse it became is because that family allowed that to happen and hired good people and let them do their thing, gave them free reign. And in the ensuing days of radio after that, eventually the radio got very homogenized and a lot of stations would end up being owned by one owner who was mostly profit-oriented. And I just want to, it's a bit of a shout-out to the Bingham family for those days because they established a standard in both radio and television and with their newspaper that gave people like me and you an opportunity to be to shine. Those were, in my opinion, the golden days of radio. And it wasn't just my era. It goes back to, the 30s and 40s, the flood coverage in 1937.
The Foster Brookses and people
there. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tom Brooks, all those people were there.
And not to mention the incredible community outreach that was created by the Crusade for Children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Still going strong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have much personal contact with the Binghams at all? You worked for their company, did you?
I longed to. Mm-hmm. I heard many stories, but no, I didn't have much contact with them. I do remember Barry Jr.'s handlebar mustache. Whenever he would walk through the station, he was such a character, and I love that mustache. I wanted a picture of it, so I never got a picture of it.
My first introduction to him was in the production studio.
Mm-hmm.
This was probably 19, well, I came in 73, so it was shortly after that. But I remember I was at the station, till 5 or 6 o'clock one evening. Everybody had gone, and I'm walking through by where the studio was, and I heard these jungle sounds coming out, and I had not met Barry Bingham Jr. And I walked to see what was going on. This gentleman turned around with his huge mustache. He said, "Hi, I'm Barry Bingham Jr." And he had been on a safari and had recorded all of these jungle sounds and was transferring them to tape there in the production studio.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was in your production studio. That was interesting. Let's see. Now, were you there during the transition to Clear Channel, or had you left?
I had left.
Because that happened like in the latter part of 85, so you left just before that.
And I did have a great opportunity to be with one of the spend time with and be Kaywood Ledger.
Kaywood Ledger.
Who came in to my studio a couple of times to record things, but for the most part was off doing his thing. At the time when I came, he was the sports anchor on television. His primary job was play-by-play for the Wildcats, and he did afternoon sports reports. He was soon to be replaced by his protege, Paul Rogers. He still worked there. And I remember when he decided to retire from his radio job and just concentrate entirely upon his own company and his wife, his play-by-play stuff. This is a guy, by the way, and this is what WHAS nurtured in talent. This is a guy, by the way, who comes from a small town in Kentucky. Eventually ended up being the play-by-play guy for the University of Kentucky Wildcats, football, basketball. And eventually became so well-known for the quality of his play-by-play that CBS television, when it was covering the NCAA Final Four, and I think it was last year on the air for the Wildcats, and Jim Nance and Billy Packer decided to, during the Final Four, let part of the audio for about 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They switched over to Caleb C. because that was the one thing he did nationally. He covered for CBS Radio and did the play-by-play for the Final Four and the championship game. And when you heard him do play-by-play for anything, everyone else paled in comparison, even people you thought were tremendous. He was one of those enormously successful talents. And since he's not around to tell this story, I'm gonna tell this story for you. He told me this story, and then he told it many times in speeches he gave later. He attributes to a general manager at a small station. I forget what town it was. It was his early day in Zim Radio. He was probably maybe 22 years old, 24. Caleb, I knew was an establishment figure to me. He was just as sophisticated as they come, a great down-to-earth guy at the same time, and a tremendous talent. But in his early days, he was a playboy, a carouser, and his wife would tell you many stories about that when she met him. So in those days, when he was starting out in radio, and this is the story he tells, one particularly, shall we say, fun night that he had, in which he was up pretty late, he did the 5 o'clock sports report on him. Well, so he's been up all night, and it's like he doesn't get up until like noon that day or 1 o'clock, and he barely gets himself to the station in time, and it's 5 o'clock rolls around, and he puts together his sports report. The general manager calls him into his office the next morning. He waits a day. And he says, Caleb, I was listening to your report yesterday, and this strange thing, I just don't think it was up to your standards. And I was wondering why. I've never heard anything like that before, and I'm really worried. Are you okay? Is there anything I can do to help you? Would you like to talk about anything? And, Caleb said when he came into his general manager's office, he knew what it was going to be about. And yet, the approach the general manager took to Caleb's, carousing was, you're okay, aren't you? Because that wasn't like you. That report wasn't like you at all. And I know you pride yourself on your reports. And he's waiting for the bomb to fall, and the hammer never drops, like you're fired or go for another job. Well, I just wanted to check with you, Caleb said that episode in that general manager's office that particular day set the stage for the rest of his career.
I'll be there.
He said, I decided right then and there, never again was I going to let anything interfere with the quality of what I was capable of and the work I was doing.
Interesting.
From that day forward, that was going to take top priority. And it was all because his GM had understood that the most important thing he needed to remind Caleb of was his own pride.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not how you messed up the day before, but remind you of your pride and your work. And that's a theme that I think Hugh Barr created at HAS. I think Caleb was a part of the early days of that. The Bingham set the stage for that, letting their people, hiring great people and letting them do what they do best, and hiring managers and leaders who knew how to bring the best out in people. And I think that's why the station
with Gary Burbeck and great personalities like yourself.
There was this team spirit, this team effort, and a camaraderie that I don't think can be replicated today. Yeah.
Well, talk about Hugh Barr some. How did you meet Hugh? And you had a good relationship with Hugh over those years. What was he like?
My image of Hugh is he had a mustache and a beard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little goatee beard.
Yeah.
And I thought Hugh was the coolest, most sophisticated guy I had ever met in radio or in any other.
All thin fellow.
Yes. And refined and soft-spoken. And did he wear a bow tie sometimes? I have a memory of that. I just remember him always being well-groomed and well-dressed and well-spoken.
Always in control. Not in a controlling way, but anyway.
Not in a controlling way at all. He wasn't manipulative and trying to get what he wanted out of people by, fooling them into doing it. He was just very straightforward and honest and so calm about it. What I loved about Hugh was his creativity to try new things and to take risks. And I think that's the legacy he left at AJS. And it is, other people emulate that in the radio community, and then it broadens beyond that. When I first, my first contact with him was, I had sent an audition tape to the station when I was up in Indianapolis, and he called me.
To be a production person?
Yeah. Well, they had an opening, and they didn't say what it was. They just said, we have an opening on our staff. To understand, Hugh created the transition from the 40s and 50s in which outfits like WHS, which was a television station, and two radio stations that worked, they were all under the same umbrella, would have an announcer staff.
And by that time, television was pretty much in control. Radio was sort of a...
Right. So before you guys were hired, Jerry David and yourself and Wayne Perkey, there was Jim Walton and Bill Britton and Van Vance, and all those guys weren't specifically sportscasters or newscasters. They were announcers, assigned to do news or assigned to do sports, and they never touched a piece of equipment. There were engineers who took care of that. And this was true at many of the large television radio station combinations around the country. When Hugh came in, he had to change that whole system. And it was entrenched. And to create a more free-flowing, creative environment for people like yourself to blossom and do what you
do. That was the trend in radio.
That was the trend in radio. And
Wave was already doing it.
They were. That's right. HAS was still doing the old-fashioned stuff, having a staff of announcers. And he wanted to hire specialists. And he knew some of the people that had been with the station for quite some time, also announced for the television station, also did some TV news, also did radio, or they did sports, or they... There were even guys who used to go into an announce booth in the 40s and do live announcements for the television station. Milton Metz used to do that.
Well, I came in 73. We were still doing, we were recording it, but that was part of our shift. We would go up into the television booth and record breaks for the night.
So you have to credit Hugh with convincing the Binghams to change the whole feel of the station and to make and to bring in the people. And they had not experienced that. So it was the power of his personality. Mm.
He was the right guy for it.
Right guy for it, because he was able to convince people of just about anything. Mm. He had that enormous confidence that he was right, not in an arrogant way, more in a, trust me, let's try it.
Were you ever in any meetings where he had to be tough, but he didn't come across his toughness? Were you ever in meetings with him like that? Were you had to negotiate something or do something?
Yes, and I feel like it was the power of his ability to persuade. That was that toughness. When you can't refute an argument, well made, I consider the guy on the other side of the table tough, because especially if he does it in a non-threatening way, and I don't think he was ever threatening. In any way, so you felt like you could say what you needed to say.
his argument was usually better because he had always thought through to the end game.
He
knew where he was going, and in fact, I think he taught me a lot about negotiating and about persuasion and how to get along.
That's interesting because you became the union shop steward at AJS and here at the printing house of the blind. I'm sure some of those skills were helpful to you there.
And there's a little story about who was then the GM of WJS Inc., which was the television station and the two radio stations. So he was over all of that. He was under him. I think by this time he had left. His name was Fred Osler. And he was a younger guy. He wasn't one of the old shade guys. He was really a younger guy who was real sophisticated, an easygoing, fun guy, too, and a real administrator. And so many years later, after he left, we had a negotiation while he was there.
Contract negotiations between the union and AFRA.
Between AFRA and the management. And represented by him, he was rarely ever in the room. He had either the program director or the general manager of the radio station there. And all we were really haggling over was a proposal to give all of the radio guys a five-day week. And many of us were still working a weekend day on the air. Only three or five, four guys left. It was going to cost the station maybe $5,000 in pay to some extra part-timers to do that. Station was doing extremely well at that time. They dug in their heels and we're not going to do that. And we made a presentation that, you know, would rival the best. You know, this isn't going to cost you this much money and here's how we can work it out. We were doing better work for them. So Fred Osler is getting these reports. And in the end, they wanted to see how badly we wanted this. So they forced what's called a strike authorization vote, and that had never happened at HAS. So I go around to everybody, and most people said, okay, well, we'll give you the authorization to call a strike. This was to our union rep, and one or two of the guys were a little shaky on it. So our union rep went back to the table, and he wouldn't do the strike authorization board. He was a little afraid that if they pushed him any further, he would have to call a strike and it wouldn't work. So we didn't get the five-day week is the bottom line, and it was okay. Eventually, two or three years later, it just happened because it made sense. Many, many years later, Fred Osler has by this time moved to Florida. He's running a cable company down there, and my wife at the time, Barbara Polk, she had taken a mini vacation with her son down there, and she, out of nowhere, she ran into him at a restaurant. And so she sat down with him, and one of the questions, he was such an outgoing guy, and they just had a great talk. How's John doing? And how's Milton, all those guys, how are they doing? And she said, oh, well, as far as I know, everybody's doing. John, you know, he still talks about you. Oh, yeah, I remember. I remember those union negotiations. Now, he was never present in the room.
Yeah.
And she said, yeah, I remember how frustrated he was. They couldn't get the five-day week. And Fred said, oh, yeah, that. All I wanted to do was see how badly you wanted it. If you had told me you would have, if you had authorized a strike, I would have given it to you. It was a moot point because several years later it came anyway, and he just laughed about it. And it does prove to you in all negotiations, whether it's between union and management or negotiation between a husband and a wife, there's always a solution if you get in the other person's shoes. And he had already done that. I and others had tried to do that. The one thing we missed was he just wanted to see.
You were serious. Don't have to, I won't. That's wild.
I guess the larger point is all the great personalities from management down to the part-time people. All great people.
Yeah.
I could go on and on.
Yeah.
You know, during the years wasn't it Hugh that started the helicopter coverage?
Yeah, Dick Gilbert.
Dick Gilbert. I remember what a great personality he was.
great stuff. And he also carved out the news department. I think Glenn Baston was the news director, and then it became on some one later under Brian Rubin, won I think 5 Peabody Awards, which were just unheard of.
You know,
for a local radio station.
I remember Jerry David came to me at one point and said, "Listen, I'm going to hire another swing guy." And I said, "Is my job safe?" Well, of course, we need somebody else who can do some other stuff, and I want you to listen to this tape. Well, I listened to the tape. I said, "Scott," he said, when you listen to it, remember the guy is 19. And I said, 19? And he's from Lebanon Junction, Kentucky. Okay, well, couldn't be much, right?
Yeah.
So I listened to the tape, and out comes this velvet deep voice, and with just a slight accent to it, you know, like almost like a Texas accent, a little bit of Kentucky in it, and just syrup. I mean, just so beautiful a voice. And I said, "Wow!" And he's 19. Jeez, but okay. And then I thought, this guy is gonna—he's gonna take all my clients away. I'm gonna be, you know. So I had to give a recommendation because he's good, you know. So he comes in, and I meet him. He's got cowboy boots on. He's got a cowboy hat on. He's got a cowboy, a western shirt on, and tight jeans. And I go, "Who is this guy?" And he introduces, "Hello, my name's Bill Cody, also known as Trent Klutz." His real name was Trent Klutz. So he had changed his name in his early days in radio when he was 16 to Bill Cody.
And he looked like he was 16 when he walked out that first time.
And he probably was at HAS for 6-7 years. He is now the morning drive personality at the VSM in Nashville.
Wow.
He was for many years one of the hosts of one of the Nashville network television networks shows. He had been lead personality on the Grand Ole Opry shows on the VSM. He loved country music.
Yeah.
But he came to HAS, not WAMC, the country station. And he filled in everywhere, and he was a lot of fun. Everybody loved him.
He had a smile on his face.
Yeah.
And that voice, you didn't expect that voice to come out.
That's right. And the reason I'm telling you about Trent Klutz is because the production room was a place for people to come in, close the door, and tell John their problems.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I didn't start it. But it started to happen. I don't know who it was that started it, and then I guess the word got around, and we'd be through recording a commercial, and we'd be through it, and I'd say, "So how you doing, Jack?" And well, I can't believe that UR has me doing this, or whatever.
Yeah, right.
And there would be, and I would say, "Well, maybe he's got a reason for that." And so it would be a place for people to talk about things.
A little sanctuary.
And it wouldn't go any further than that. Yeah. It was just a place to let off a little steam. I don't know how it got started, but it became a thing. So one day, after Trent had been there about 5 years, and he's still doing the same thing, filling in for people. And he's not gotten an airship, which was his main goal.
Sure.
And he was hoping one day to maybe be morning drive or afternoon drive on WAMZ, because, that was still part of the group. And by that time, Coyote Calhoun had taken over AMZ and really wanted him, but there wasn't an opening. And there wasn't one for several years. So Trent was getting, I got to move on. I got to do something. I'm 24.
Life is about over.
So he comes into the production room, and he says, "John, I really have a dilemma. I've been offered a job at it was a country station in, I think it was Jacksonville, Florida. Or Tampa, one of those places. And it's a great opportunity. It's morning drive, and leaving home." He was a homeboy. He just loved Kentucky. And married, always married, and had a couple of kids. And he said, "I don't know what to do. I have no idea what to do." And I had learned this some years ago. Somebody had done this for me. So I said, "Hey, it's a simple solution." He said, "Oh, good, I'm so glad. I knew you'd have the answer." So I said, "Have you got a coin?" And he got a coin out, and I said, "Here, heads, you're going to Jacksonville. Tails, you stay at HAS, and I want you, before you do this, I want you to commit, and you're, that whatever it says, you're going to do it. And he says, okay, this can't be any worse than what I've been going through, you know. And so he accepted the premise. So we flipped the coin, and while it was in the air, this is the trick, while it was in the air, I said, what do you want it to be? And his face froze, and I said, you got to tell me, because we're not picking up that coin. The idea is you never look at the coin. And I said, tell me the truth. What did you want it to be? And he wanted it to be heads, I go to Jacksonville. And he told me that. He said, I want it to be heads. There's your answer.
How about that?
And he went. That job didn't work out, but it led to another very prestigious country music job. And then he ended up at WSM, the premier country station in the country. And that led to lots of other things, Nashville Network, and I saw him. We had a reunion of the HAS guys over at Glenn Baston's house a few years back, and he came.
That's something.
Great guy.
And the production studio was also a counseling center. That too.
5 cents.
How about that? Great stuff. Well, we're going to run out of time here. You're going to have to get ready to do a recording session, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But anything else you want to add? Great stuff. Great memories. As you said, we could probably come back tomorrow and do another hour.
Just keep it going. If I think of anything, I'll let you know.
Some great insights and some good memories, obviously.
It was a wonderful time, and the good fortune to have that opportunity. Weren't many people had the opportunity to work at that radio station.
And longevity, they're going to be there for a long, long time.
A long time. That's not so much true anymore in the business, but it was certainly true then. And so many people wanted to work there, like Trent, who had dreamed of it ever since he was a little kid, and myself and many others. Once you came from, Denver, you never left.
Yeah, that's right.
And Wayne, he came
from 40 years.
Schultz
was there 40 years. Did you know that?
It's that way.
No, 30 years. 30 years. 30 years. Yeah. I think 30 years. 30 years. 30 years.
We turned him into Kentucky, didn't we?
That's right.
Once a Kentuckian, always.
He's in the blood. Blue blood. Well, thanks, John.
You're welcome.
Good stuff. And
thanks for the chance to participate.
You're well. Thanks.
Okay.